Cortez had been gone only an hour when a telex came in, informing him that last night's courier flight had failed to arrive at its destination in southwestern Georgia. The amusement that invariably accompanies receipt of top-secret information changed at once to anger. El Jefe thought to call Cortez on his mobile phone, but remembered that his hireling refused to discuss substantive matters over what he called a non-secure line. Escobedo shook his head. This colonel of the DGI. He was an old woman. El Jefe's phone twittered its own signal. Bingo, a man said in a van 2,000 miles away. Vox ident, his computer screen announced. Subject Bravo initiated call to subject Echo, frequency 848.970 megahertz, call initiated 2349Z, intercept ident 345. We may have our first big one here, Tony. The senior technician, who'd been christened Antonio 47 years earlier, put on his headphones. The conversation was being taken down on high-speed tape. It was actually a three-quarter-inch videotape because of the nature of the system used to intercept the signal. Four separate machines recorded the signal. They were Sony commercial recorders, only slightly modified by the NSA technical staff. Ha! Senor Bravo is pissed, Tony observed as he caught part of the conversation. Tell me that we finally caught a frozen rope down the left field line. A frozen rope was the current NSA nickname for a very important signal intercept. It was baseball season and the Baltimore Orioles were coming back. How's the signal? Clear as a church bell. Christ, why don't I ever buy TRW stock? Antonio paused, struggling not to laugh. God, is he pissed! The call ended a minute later. Tony switched his headphone input to one of the tape machines and crab-walked his swivel chair to a teleprinter where he started typing. Flash. Top secret. Caper. 2358Z. SIGINT report. Intercept 345, initiated 2349Z, frequency 836.970 megahertz. Initiated, subject Bravo. Recipient, subject Echo. B. We've lost another delivery. Agitation. E. What happened? B. The cursed thing didn't appear. What do you think? Agitation. E. They're doing something different. I told you that. We're trying to find out what it is. B. So when are you going to know? E. We're working on that. Our man is traveling to Washington to find out. There are some other things happening also. B. What? Agitation. E. I propose we meet tomorrow to discuss it. B. The regular meeting is Tuesday. E. This is important. Everyone must hear it, Pablo. B. Can't you tell me anything? E. They are changing the rules, the North Americans. Exactly how they are changing them, we do not yet know. B. Well, what are we paying that Cuban renegade for? Agitation. E. He is doing very well. Perhaps he will learn more on his trip to Washington. But what we have learned to this point will be the subject of our meeting. B. Very well. I will set up the meeting. E. Thank you, Pablo. End call. Disconnect signal. End intercept. What's this agitation business? I can't put pissed in an official TWX, Antonio pointed out. This one's hot. We have some operational intel here. He pressed the transmit key on his terminal. The signal was addressed to a code word destination, Caper, which was all anyone who worked in the van knew. Bob Ritter had just left for home and was only a mile up on the George Washington Parkway when his secure car phone made its distinctive and, to him, irritating noise. Yeah, Caper traffic. The voice said. Right. The deputy director of operations said with a suppressed sigh to his driver, take me back. Yes, sir. Getting back, even for a top CIA executive, meant finding a place to reverse course and then fight the late D.C. rush hour traffic, which, in its majesty, allows rich, poor, and important to crawl at an equal 20 miles per hour. The gate guard waved the car through, and he was in his seventh-floor office 5 minutes after that. Judge Moore was already gone. There were only four watch officers cleared for this operation. That was the minimum number required merely to wait for and evaluate signal traffic on the operation. The current watch officer had just come on duty. He handed over the signal. We have something hot, the officer said. You're not kidding. It's Cortez, Ritter observed after scanning the message form. Good bet, sir. Coming here. But we don't know what he looks like. If only the Bureau had gotten a picture of the bastard when he was in Puerto Rico. You know the description we have of him, Ritter looked up. Black and brown, medium height, medium build, sometimes wears a mustache, no distinguishing marks or characteristics, the officer recited from memory. It wasn't hard to memorize nothing, and nothing was exactly what they had on Felix Cortez. Who's your contact at the Bureau? Tom Burke, middle-level guy in the Intelligence Division. Pretty good man. He handled part of the Henderson case. Okay, get this to him. Maybe the Bureau can figure a way to bag the bastard. Anything else? No, sir. Ritter nodded and resumed his trip home. The watch officer returned to his own office on the fifth floor and made his call. He was in luck this night. Burke was still at his office. They couldn't discuss the matter over the phone, of course. The CIA watch officer, Paul Hooker, drove over to the FBI building at 10th and Pennsylvania. Though CIA and FBI are sometimes rivals in the intelligence business, and always rivals for federal budget funds, at the operational level their employees get along well enough. The barbs they trade are good-natured ones. There's a new tourist coming into D.C. in the next few days, Hooker announced once the door was closed. Like who? Burke inquired, gesturing to his coffee machine. Hooker declined. Felix Cortez. The CIA officer handed over a Xerox of the telex. Portions of it had been blacked out, of course. Burke didn't take offense at this. As a member of the intelligence division charged with catching spies, he was accustomed to need to know. You're assuming that it's Cortez, the FBI agent pointed out. Then he smiled. But I wouldn't bet against you. If we had a picture of this clown, we'd stand a fair chance of bagging him. As it is, a sigh, I'll put people at Dulles, National, and BWI. We'll try, but you can guess what the odds are. If the agency had gotten a photo of this mutt while he was in the field or while he was at the KGB Academy, it would make our job a hell of a lot easier. I'll assume that he's coming in over the next 4 days. We'll check all flights directly in from down there and all connecting flights. The problem was more one of mathematics than anything. The number of direct flights from Colombia, Venezuela, Panama, and other nearby countries directly into the D.C. area was quite modest and easy to cover. But if the subject made a connecting flight through Puerto Rico, the Bahamas, Mexico, or any number of other cities, including American ones, the number of possible connections increased by a factor of 10. If he made one more intermediary stop in the United States, the number of possible flights for the FBI to monitor took a sudden jump into the hundreds. Cortez was a KGB-trained pro, and he knew that fact as well as these two men did. The task wasn't a hopeless one. Police play for breaks all the time, because even the most skilled adversaries get careless or unlucky. But that was the game here. Their only real hope was a lucky break, which they would not get. Cortez caught an Avianca flight to Mexico City, then an American Airlines flight to Dallas-Fort Worth, where he cleared customs and made yet another American connection to New York City. He checked into the St. Moritz Hotel on Central Park South. By this time, it was 3 a.m, and he needed some rest. He left a wake-up call for 10 and asked the concierge to have him a first-class ticket for the 11 o'clock Metroliner into Union Station, Washington, D.C. The Metroliners, he knew, had their own phones. He'd be able to call ahead if something went wrong. Or maybe... No, he decided. He didn't want to call her at work. Surely the FBI tapped its own phones. The last thing Cortez did before collapsing onto the bed was to shred his plane ticket receipts and the baggage tags on his luggage. The phone awoke him at 9:56. Almost 7 hours sleep, he thought. It seemed like only a few seconds, but there was no time to dawdle. Half an hour later, he appeared at the desk, tossed in his express checkout form, and collected his train ticket. The usual Manhattan midtown traffic nearly caused him to miss the train, but he made it, taking a seat in the last row of the 3-across club car smoking section. A smiling, red-vested attendant started him off with decaffeinated coffee and a copy of USA Today, followed by a breakfast that was no different, though a little warmer, from what he'd have gotten on an airliner. By the time the train stopped in Philadelphia, he was back asleep. Cortez figured that he'd need his rest. The attendant noted the smile on his sleeping face as he collected the breakfast tray and wondered what dreams passed through the passenger's head. At 1 o'clock, while Metroliner 111 approached Baltimore, the TV lights were switched on in the White House press room. The reporters had already been prepped with a deep background not-for-attribution briefing that there would be a major announcement from the Attorney General and that it would have something to do with drugs. The major networks did not interrupt their afternoon soap operas. It was no small thing to cut away from The Young and the Restless. But CNN, as usual, put up their special report graphic. This was noticed at once by the intelligence watch officers in the Pentagon's National Military Command Center, each of whom had a TV on his desk tuned into CNN. That was perhaps the most eloquent comment possible on the ability of America's intelligence agencies to keep its government informed, but one on which the major networks, for obvious reasons, had never commented. The Attorney General strode haltingly toward the lectern. For all his experience as a lawyer, he was not an effective public speaker. You didn't need to be if your practice was corporate law and political campaigning. He was, however, photogenic and a sharp dresser and always good for a leak on a slow news day, which explained his popularity with the media. Ladies and gentlemen, he began fumbling with his notes, you will soon be getting handouts concerning Operation Tarpon. This represents the most effective operation to date against the international drug cartel. He looked up, trying to see the reporters' faces past the glare of the lights. Investigation by the Department of Justice, led by the FBI, has identified a number of bank accounts, both in the United States and elsewhere, which are being used for money laundering on an unprecedented scale. These accounts range over 29 banks from Liechtenstein to California, and their deposits exceed, at our current estimates, over $650 million. He looked up again as he heard a "God damn" from the assembled multitude. That elicited a smile. It was never easy to impress the White House press corps. The auto-line cameras were really churning away now. In cooperation with six foreign governments, we have initiated the necessary steps to seize all those funds and also to seize eight real estate joint venture investments here in the United States, which were the primary agency in the actual laundering operation. This is being done under the RICO, the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organization Statute. I should emphasize on that point that the real estate ventures involve the holdings of many innocent investors. Their holdings will not, I repeat, not be affected in any way by the government's action. They were used as dupes by the cartel, and they will not be harmed by these seizures. Excuse me, Associated Press interrupted. You did say $650 million? That is correct. More than $500 million. The AG described generally how the information had been found, but not the way in which the first lead had been obtained, nor the precise mechanisms used to track the money. As you know, we have treaties with several foreign governments to cover cases such as this. Those funds, identified as drug-related and deposited in foreign banks, will be confiscated by the governments in question. In Swiss accounts, for example, are approximately, he checked his notes again, it looks like $237 million, all of which now belongs to the Swiss government. What's our take? The Washington Post asked. We don't know yet. It's difficult to describe the complexity of this operation. Just the accounting is going to keep us busy for weeks. What about cooperation from the foreign governments? Another reporter wanted to know. You gotta be kidding, the journalist next to him thought. The cooperation we've received on this case is simply outstanding, the attorney general beamed. Our friends overseas have moved with dispatch and professionalism. Not every day you can steal this much money and call it something for the public good, the quiet journalist told herself. CNN is a worldwide service. The broadcast was monitored in Colombia by two men whose job it was to keep track of the American news media. They were journalists themselves, in fact, who worked for the Colombian TV network, InRevision. One of them excused himself from the control room and made a telephone call before returning. Tony and his partner had just come back on duty in the van, and there was a telex clipped to the wall, telling them to expect some activity on the cellular phone circuits at about 1800 Zulu time. They weren't disappointed. Can we talk to Director Jacobs about this? A reporter asked. Director Jacobs is taking a personal interest in the case, but is not available for comment, the AG answered. You'll be able to talk to him next week, but at the moment he and his team are all pretty busy. That didn't break any rules. It gave the impression that Emil was in town, and the reporters, recognizing exactly what the Attorney General had said and how he had said it, collectively decided to let it slide. In fact, Emil had taken off from Andrews Air Force Base 25 minutes earlier. Madre de Dios, Escobedo observed. The meeting had barely gotten past the usual social pleasantries so necessary for a conference of cutthroats. All the members of the cartel were in the same room, which happened rarely enough. Even though the building was surrounded with a literal wall of security people, they were nervous about their safety. The building had a satellite dish on the roof, and this was immediately tuned into CNN. What was supposed to have been a discussion of unexpected happenings in their smuggling operations was suddenly sidetracked onto something far more troubling. It was especially troubling for Escobedo, moreover, since he'd been one of the three cartel members who had urged this money laundering scheme on his colleagues. Though all had complimented him on the efficiency of the arrangement over the last 2 years, the looks he was getting now were somewhat less supportive. There is nothing we can do? One asked. It is too early to tell, replied the cartel's equivalent of a chief financial officer. I remind you that the money we have already taken completely through the arrangements nearly equals what our normal returns would be. So you can say that we have lost very little other than the gain we expected to reap from our investments. That sounded lame even to him. I think we have tolerated enough interference, Escobedo said forcefully. The director of the American Federales will be here in Bogota later today. Oh? And how did you discover this? Cortez, I told you that hiring him would be to our benefit. I called this meeting to give you the information that he has gotten for us. This is too much to accept, another member agreed. We should take action. It must be forceful. There was general agreement. The cartel had not yet learned that important decisions ought never to be taken in anger, but there was no one to counsel moderation. These men were not known for that quality in any case. Train 111, Metroliner service from New York, arrived a minute early at 1:48 p.m. Cortez walked off, carrying his two bags, and walked at once to the taxi stand at the front of the station. The cab driver was delighted to have a fare to Dulles. The trip took just over 30 minutes, earning the cabbie what for Cortez was a decent tip, $2. He entered the upper level, walked to his left, took the escalator down where he found the Hertz counter. Here he rented another large Chevy and took the spare time to load his bags. By the time he returned inside, it was nearly 3. Moira was right on time. They hugged. She wasn't one to kiss in so public a place. Where did you park?
In the long-term lot. I left my bags in the car.
Then we will go and get them.
Where are we going?
There is a place on Skyline Drive where General Motors occasionally holds important conferences. There are no phones in the rooms, no televisions, no newspapers.
I know it. How did you ever get a reservation at this late notice?
I've been reserving a suite for every weekend since we were last together, Cortez explained truthfully. He stopped dead in his tracks. That sounds improper. He had the halting embarrassment down pat by this time. Moira grabbed his arm.
Not to me.
I can tell that this will be a long weekend. Within minutes, they were on Interstate 66, heading west toward the Blue Ridge Mountains. Four embassy security officers dressed in airline coveralls gave the area a final look. Then one of them pulled out a sophisticated satellite radio phone and gave the final clearance. The VC-20A, the military version of the G-3 executive jet, flew in with a commercial setting on its radar transponder, landing at 5:39 in the afternoon at El Dorado International Airport, about 8 miles outside of Bogota. Unlike most of the VC-20As belonging to the 89th Military Airlift Wing at Andrews Air Force Base, Maryland, this one was specially modified to fly into high-threat areas and carried jamming gear originally invented by the Israelis to counter surface-to-air missiles in the hands of terrorists or businessmen. The aircraft flared out and made a perfect landing into gentle westerly winds, then taxied to a distant corner of the cargo terminal, the one the cars and jeeps were heading for. The aircraft's identity was no longer a secret to anyone who bothered to look, of course. It had barely stopped when the first jeeps formed up on its left side. Armed soldiers dismounted and spread out, their automatic weapons pointed at threats that might have been imaginary or might not. The aircraft's door dropped down. There were stairs built into it, but the first man off the plane didn't bother with them. He jumped, with one hand hidden in the right side of a top coat. He was soon joined by another security guard. Each man was a special agent of the FBI, and the job of each was the physical safety of their boss, Director Emil Jacobs. They stood within the ring of Colombian soldiers, each of whom was a member of an elite counterinsurgency unit. Every man there was nervous. There was nothing routine about security in this country. Too many had died proving otherwise. Jacobs came out next, accompanied by his own special assistant and Harry Jefferson, administrator of the Drug Enforcement Administration. The last of the three stepped down just as the ambassador's limousine pulled up. It didn't stop for long. The ambassador did step out to greet his guests, but all of them were inside the car a minute later. Then the soldiers remounted their jeeps, which moved off to escort the ambassador. The aircraft's crew chief closed the Gulfstream's door, and the VC-20A, whose engines had never stopped turning, immediately taxied to take off again. Its destination was the airfield at Grenada, thoughtfully built for the Americans by the Cubans only a few years before. It would be easier to guard it there. "How was the flight, Emil?" the ambassador asked. "Just over 5 hours, not bad," the director allowed. He leaned back on the velvet seat of the stretch limo, which was filled to capacity. In front were the ambassador's driver and bodyguard. That made a total of 4 machine guns in the car, and he was sure Harry Jefferson carried a service automatic. Jacobs had never carried a gun in his life, didn't wish to bother with the things, and besides, if his 2 bodyguards and his assistant, another crack shot, didn't suffice to protect him, what would? It wasn't that Jacobs was an especially courageous man, just that after nearly 40 years of dealing with criminals of all sorts, the Chicago mob had once threatened him quite seriously. He was tired of it all. He'd grown as comfortable as any man can be with such a thing. It was part of the scenery now, like a pattern in a wallpaper or the color of a room's paint. He no longer noticed it. He did notice the altitude. The city of Bogota sits at an elevation of nearly 8,700 feet on a plain among towering mountains. There was no air to breathe here, and he wondered how the ambassador tolerated it. Jacobs was more comfortable with the biting winter winds off Lake Michigan. Even the humid pall that visited Washington every summer was better than this, he thought.
Tomorrow night at 9, right? Jacobs asked. Yep, the ambassador nodded. I think they'll go along with nearly anything we want. The ambassador, of course, didn't know what the meeting was about, which did not please him. He'd worked as chargé d'affaires at Moscow, and the security there wasn't as tight as it was here. That's not the problem, Jefferson observed. I know they mean well. They've lost enough cops and judges proving that. Question is, will they play ball? Would we, under similar circumstances, Jacobs mused, then steered the conversation in a safer direction. You know, we've never been especially good neighbors, have we? How do you mean? The ambassador asked. I mean, when it suited us to have these countries run by thugs, we let it happen. When democracy finally started to take root, we often as not stood at the sidelines and bitched if their ideas didn't agree fully with ours. And now that the druggies threaten their governments because of what our own citizens want to buy, we blame them. Democracy comes hard down here, the ambassador pointed out. The Spanish weren't real big on... If we'd done our job 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, we wouldn't have half the problems we have now. Well, we didn't do it then. We sure as hell have to do it now. If you have any suggestions, Emil, Jacobs laughed. Hell, Andy, I'm a cop. Well, a lawyer, not a diplomat. That's your problem. How's Kay? Just fine. Ambassador Andy Westerfield didn't have to ask about Mrs. Jacobs. He knew Emil had buried his wife 9 months earlier after a courageous fight with cancer. He'd taken it hard, of course, but there were so many good things to remember about Ruth. And he had a job to keep him busy. Everyone needed that, and Jacobs more than most. In the terminal, a man with a 35mm Nikon and a long lens had been snapping pictures for the past 2 hours. When the limousine and its escort started moving off the airport grounds, he removed the lens from the body, set both in his camera case, and walked off to a bank of telephones. The limousine moved quickly, with one Jeep in front and another behind. Expensive cars with armed escorts were not terribly unusual in Colombia, and they moved out from the airport at a brisk clip. They had to spot the license plate to know that the car was American. The four men in each Jeep had not known of their escort job until 5 minutes before they left, and the route, though predictable, wasn't a long one. There shouldn't have been time for anyone to set up an ambush, assuming that anyone would be crazy enough to consider such a thing. After all, killing an American ambassador was crazy. It had only happened recently in a Sudan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and no one had ever made a serious attempt on an FBI director. The car they drove in was a Cadillac Fleetwood chassis. Its special equipment included thick Lexan windows that could stop a machine gun bullet, and Kevlar armor all around the passenger compartment. The tires were foam-filled against flattening, and the gas tank of a design similar to that used on military aircraft as protection against explosion. Not surprisingly, the car was known in the embassy motor pool as the Tank. The driver knew how to handle it as skillfully as a NASCAR professional. He had engine power to race at over 100 miles per hour. He could throw the 3-ton vehicle into a bootlegger turn in reverse directions like a movie stunt driver. His eyes flickered between the road ahead and the rearview mirror. There had been one car following them for 2 or 3 miles, but it turned off. Probably nothing, he judged. Somebody else coming home from the airport. The car also had sophisticated radio gear to call for help. They were heading to the embassy. Though the ambassador had a separate residence, a pretty 2-story house set on 6 sculpted acres of garden and woodland, it wasn't secure enough for his visitors. Like most contemporary American embassies, this one looked to be a cross between a low-rise office block and part of the Siegfried Line. Vox Ident, his computer screen read, 2,000 miles away. Voice 34, initiated call to unknown recipient. Frequency 889.980 megahertz. Call initiated 2258Z. Intercept ident 381. Tony donned the headphones and listened in on the tape delay system. Nothing, he said a moment later. Somebody's taking a drive. At the embassy, the legal attaché paced nervously in the lobby. Special Agent Pete Morales of the FBI should have been at the airport. It was his director coming in. But the security puke said only one car because it was a surprise visit. And surprise, everyone knew, was better than a massive show of force. The everybodies who knew did not include Morales, who believed in showing force. It was bad enough having to live down here. Morales was from California. Though his surname was Hispanic, his family had been in the San Francisco area when Major Fremont had arrived, and he'd had to brush up on his somewhat removed mother tongue to take his current job, which job also meant leaving his wife and kids behind in the States. As his most recent report had told headquarters, it was dangerous down here. Dangerous for the local citizens, dangerous for Americans, and very dangerous indeed for American cops. Morales checked his watch. About 2 more minutes. He started moving to the door. Right on time, a man noted 3 blocks from the embassy. He spoke into a handheld radio. Until recently, the RPG-7D had been the standard-issue Soviet light anti-tank weapon. It traces its ancestry to the German Panzerfaust and was only recently replaced by the RPG-18, a close copy of the American M-72 Law rocket. The adoption of the new weapon allowed millions of the old ones to be disposed of, adding to the already abundant supply in arms bazaars all over the world. Designed to punch holes in battle tanks, it is not an especially easy weapon to use, which was why there were four of them aimed at the ambassador's limousine. The car proceeded south down Carrera 13 in the district known as Palermo, slowing now because of the traffic. Had the director's bodyguards known the name of the district and the designation of the street, they might have objected merely on grounds of superstition. The slow speed of the traffic here in the city itself made everyone nervous, especially the soldiers in the escort jeeps who craned their necks looking up into the windows of various buildings. It is a fact so obvious as to be misunderstood that one cannot ordinarily look into a window from outside. Even an open window is merely a rectangle darker than the exterior wall, and the eye adjusts to ambient light, not to light in a specific place. There was no warning. What made the daze of the Americans inevitable was something as prosaic as a traffic light. A technician was working on a balky signal. People had been complaining about it for a week, and while checking the timing mechanism, he flipped it to red. Everyone stopped on the street almost within sight of the embassy. From third-floor windows on both sides of the street, four separate RPG-7D projectiles streaked straight down. Three hit the car, two of them on the roof. The flash was enough. Morales was moving even before the noise reached the embassy gates, and he ran with full knowledge of the futility of the gesture. His right hand wrenched his Smith & Wesson automatic from the waist holster, and he carried it, as training prescribed, pointed straight up. It took just over 2 minutes. The driver was still alive, thrown from the car and bleeding to death from holes that no doctor could ever patch in time. The soldiers in the lead jeep were nowhere to be seen, though there was blood on a rear seat. The trail jeep's driver was still at the wheel, his hands clutching at a face shredded with broken glass, and the man next to him was dead, but again the other two were gone. Then Morales knew why. Automatic weapons fire erupted in a building to his left. It started, stopped, then began again. A scream came from a window, and that also stopped. Morales wanted to race into the building, but he had no jurisdiction and was too much a professional to risk his life so foolishly. He moved up to the smashed limousine. He knew that this, too, was futile. They'd all died instantly or as quickly as any man might die. The director's two bodyguards had worn Kevlar armor. That would stop bullets, but not fragments from a high-explosive warhead, and had proven no more effective than the armor in the tank. Morales knew what had hit the car. Weapons designed to destroy tanks, real ones. For those inside, the only remarkable thing was that you could tell that they had once been human. There was nothing anyone could do except a priest or rabbi. Morales turned away after a few seconds. He stood alone in the street, still operating on his professional training, not letting his humanity affect his judgment. The one living soldier in view was too injured to move, probably had no idea where he was or what had happened to him. None of the people on the sidewalk had come to help, but some of them he saw were hurt too, and their injuries occupied the attention of the others. Morales realized the damage to the car told everyone else in view where they might best spend their efforts. The agent turned to scan up and down the street. He didn't see the technician at the light control box. The man was already gone. Two soldiers came out of a building, one carrying what looked like an RPG-7 launcher unit. Morales recognized one of them, Captain Edmundo Garza. There was blood on his khaki shirt and pants, and in his eyes the wild look that Morales hadn't seen since his time in the Marine Corps. Behind him, two more men dragged yet another who'd been shot in the arms and the groin. Morales holstered his automatic before going over, slowly, his hands visible until he was sure he'd been recognized. "Capitan," Morales said. "One more dead upstairs and one of mine. Four teams. Getaway cars in the alleys." Garza looked at the blood on his upper arm with annoyance that was rapidly changing to appreciation of his wounds, but there was something more than shock to postpone the pain. The captain looked at the car for the first time in several minutes, hoping that his immediate impression might have been wrong and knowing that it could not be. His handsome, bloody face looked at the American and received a shake by way of reply. Garza was a proud man, a professional soldier dedicated to his country as thoroughly as any man could be, and he'd been chosen for this assignment for his combination of skill and integrity. A man who did not fear death, he had just suffered the thing all soldiers fear more. He had failed in his mission. Not knowing why only made it worse. Garza continued to ignore his wounds, turning to their one prisoner. "We will talk," the captain promised him just before collapsing into Morales' arms. "Hi, Jack," Dan and Liz Murray had just arrived at the Ryan house. Dan had to remove his automatic and holster, which he sat on the shelf in the closet with something of a sheepish look. "I figured you for a revolver," Jack said with a grin. It was the first time that they'd had the Murrays over. "I missed my Python, but the Bureau's switching over to automatics. Besides, I don't chase bad guys anymore. I chase memos and position papers and budget estimates." A rueful shake of the head. "What fun." "I know the feeling," Ryan agreed, leading Murray to the kitchen. "Beer? Sounds good to me." They'd first met in London, at St. Thomas's Hospital, to be precise, some years earlier, when Murray had been legal attaché to the American Embassy, and Ryan had been a shooting victim. Still tall and spare, his hair a little thinner but not yet gray, Murray was an affable, free-spirited man whom one would never pick for a cop, much less one of the best around. A gifted investigator, he'd hunted down every sort of criminal there was, and though he now chafed at his absence from hands-on police work, he was handling his administrative job as skillfully as all his others. "What's this sting I heard about?" Jack asked. "Tarpon? The cartel murdered a guy who was laundering money for them on a very big scale and doing some major league skimming, too. He left records behind. We found them. It's been a busy couple of weeks running all the leads down. I heard 600 plus million bucks. It'll go higher. The Swiss cracked open a new account this afternoon." "Ouch." Ryan popped open a couple of beers. "That's a real sting, isn't it?" "I think they'll notice this one," Murray agreed. "What's this I hear about your new job?" "You probably heard right. It's just that you don't want to get a promotion this way." "Yeah. I never met Admiral Greer, but the director thinks a lot of him." "Two of a kind. Old-fashioned, honorable gentleman," Jack observed. "Endangered species." "Hello, Mr. Murray," Sally Ryan said from the door. "Mr. Murray? Uncle Dan." Sally raced up and delivered a ferocious hug. "Aunt Liz says that you and Daddy better get out there," she said with a giggle. "Why do we let them push us warriors around, Jack?" "Because they're tougher than we are?" Ryan wondered. Dan laughed. "Yeah, that explains it. Then his beeper went off. Murray pulled the small plastic box from his belt. In a moment, the LCD panel showed the number he was supposed to call. "You know, I'd like to waste the bastard who invented these things." "He's already dead," Jack replied deadpan. "He came into a hospital emergency room with chest pains, and after the doc figured out who he was, they were a little slow getting around to treating him. The doc explained later that he'd had an important phone call come in, and..." "Oh, well." Ryan's demeanor changed. "You need a secure line. I have one in the library." "Color me important," Murray observed. "No. Can I use this one?" "Sure. The bottom button's a DC line." Murray punched in the number without referring to his beeper. It was Shaw's office. "Murray here. You rang, Alice?" "Okay." "Hi, Bill. What gives?" It was as though the room took a sudden chill. Ryan felt it before he understood the change in Murray's face. "No chance that..." "Oh, yeah. I know, Pete." Murray checked his watch. "Be there in 40 minutes. He hung up. "What happened?" "Somebody killed the director," Dan answered simply.
"What? Where?"
"Bogota. He was down there for a quiet meeting, along with the head of DEA. Flew down this afternoon. They kept it real quiet." "No chance that..." Murray shook his head. "The attaché down there is Pete Morales. Good agent. I worked OC with him once. He said they were all killed instantly. Emil, Harry Jefferson, the ambassador, all the security guys." He stopped and read the look on Jack's face. "Yeah, somebody had some pretty good intel on this." Ryan nodded. "This is where I came in. I don't think there's a street agent in the Bureau who doesn't love that man." Murray set his beer down on the counter. "Sorry, pal. What was it you said? Endangered species?" Murray shook his head and went to collect his wife. Ryan hadn't even closed the door behind them when his secure phone started ringing. The hideaway, located only a few miles from the Luray Caverns, was a modern building despite its deliberate lack of some modern amenities. While there was no in-room cable television, no pay-for-view satellite service, no complimentary paper outside the door every morning, there was air conditioning, running water, and the room service menu was 6 pages long, supplemented by 10 full pages of wine listings. The hotel catered to newlyweds who needed few distractions and to others trying to save their marriages from distractions. Service was on the European model. The guest wasn't expected to do anything but eat, drink, and rumple the linen, though there were saddle horses, tennis courts, and a swimming pool for those whose suite didn't include a bathtub large enough for the purpose. Moira watched her lover tip the bellman $10, far more than he ever tipped anyone, before she thought to ask the most obvious question. "How did you register?" "Mr. and Mrs. Juan Diaz." Another embarrassed look. "Forgive me, but I didn't know what else to say. I didn't think," he lied, haltingly. "And I didn't want... What could I say without embarrassing myself?" he finally asked with a frustrated gesture. "Well, I need a shower. Since we are husband and wife, you may join me. It looks big enough for two." She walked from the room, dropping her silk blouse on the bed as she went. 5 minutes later, Cortez decided that the shower was easily big enough for four. But as things turned out, that was just as well. The president had flown to Camp David for the weekend and had barely showered himself when his junior military aide, a Marine lieutenant headed duty, brought him the cordless phone. "Yes, what is it?" The lieutenant's first reaction on seeing the president's expression was to wonder where his pistol was. "I want the Attorney General, Admiral Cutter, Judge Moore, and Bob Ritter flown here immediately. Tell the press secretary to call me in 15 minutes to work on the statement. I'll be staying here for the time being." "What about bringing them back home?" "Okay. We have a couple of hours to think about that. For now, the usual protocol." "That's right." "No, nothing from state. I'll handle it from here. Then the secretary can have his say. Thank you." The president pushed the kill button on the phone and handed it back to the Marine. "Sir, is there anything that the guard detail needs?" "No." The president explained briefly what had happened. "Carry on, Lieutenant." "Aye, aye, sir." The Marine left. The president put on his bathrobe and walked over to the mirror to comb his hair. He had to use the terry cloth of his sleeve to wipe the condensation off the glass. Had he noticed, he would have wondered why the look in his eyes didn't shatter it. "Okay," the President of the United States told the mirror. "So you bastards want to play?" The flight from Andrews to Camp David was made in one of the new VH-60 Black Hawk helicopters that the 89th Military Airlift Wing had just acquired. Plushly appointed to carry VIPs from place to place, it was still too noisy for anything approximating a normal conversation. Each of the four passengers stared out the windows on the sliding doors, watching the western Maryland hills slide beneath the aircraft, each alone with his grief and his anger. The trip took 20 minutes. The pilot had been told to hurry. On touching down, the four men were loaded into a car for the short drive to the president's cabin on the grounds. They found him hanging up the phone. It had taken half an hour to locate his press secretary, further exacerbating the president's already stormy mood. Admiral Cutter started to say something about how sorry everyone was, but the president's expression cut him short. The president sat down on a couch opposite the fireplace. In front of him was what most people ordinarily took to be a coffee table. But now, with the top removed, it was a set of computer screens and quiet thermal printers that tapped into the major newswire services and other government information channels. Four television sets were in the next room, tuned in to CNN and the major networks. The four visitors stared down at him, watching the anger come off the president like steam from a boiling pot. "We will not let this one slip past with us standing by and deploring the event," the president said quietly as he looked up. "They killed my friend. They killed my ambassador. They have directly challenged the sovereign power of the United States of America. They want to play with the big boys," the president went on in a voice that was grotesquely calm. "Well, they're going to have to play by the big boys' rules." "Peter," he said to the AG, "there is now an informal presidential finding that the drug cartel has initiated an undeclared war against the government of the United States. They have chosen to act like a hostile nation state. We will treat them as we would treat a hostile nation state. As president, I am resolved to carry the fight to the enemy as we would carry it to any other originator of state-sponsored terrorism." The AG didn't like that, but nodded agreement anyway. The president turned to Moore and Ritter. "The gloves come off. I just made the usual wimpy-ass statement for my press secretary to deliver, but the fucking gloves come off. Come up with a plan. I want these bastards hurt. No more of this sending a message crap. I want them to get the message whether the phone rings or not. Mr. Ritter, you have your hunting license, and there's no bag limit. Is that sufficiently clear?" "Yes, sir," the DDO answered. Actually, it wasn't. The president hadn't said kill once, as the tape recorders that were surely somewhere in this room would show. But there were some things that you didn't do. And one of them was that you did not force the president to speak clearly when clarity was something he wished to avoid. "Find yourselves a cabin and come up with a plan. Peter, I want you to stay here with me for a while. The next message, the Attorney General, once having acceded to the president's desire to do something, didn't need to know exactly what was going to be done. Admiral Cutter, who was more familiar with Camp David than the other two, led the way to one of the guest cabins. Since he was in front, Moore and Ritter could not see the smile on his face. Ryan was just getting to his office, having driven himself in, a habit which he had just unlearned. The senior intelligence watch officer was waiting for him in the corridor as Jack got off the elevator. The briefing took a whole 4 minutes, after which Ryan found himself sitting in the office with nothing at all to do. It was strange. He was now privy to everything the U.S. government knew about the assassination of its people, not much more than what he'd heard on the car radio coming in, actually, though he now had names to put on the unnamed sources. Sometimes that was important, but not this time. The DCI and DDO, he learned at once, were up at Camp David with the president. Why not me? Jack asked himself in surprise. It should have occurred to him immediately, of course, but he was not yet used to being a senior executive. With nothing to do, his mind went along that tangent for several minutes. The conclusion was an obvious one. He didn't need to know what was being talked about. But that had to mean that something was already happening, didn't it? If so, what? And for how long? By noon the next day, an Air Force C-141B Starlifter transport had landed at El Dorado International. Security was like nothing anyone had seen since the funeral of Anwar Sadat. Armed helicopters circled overhead. Armored vehicles sat with their gun tubes trained outward. A full battalion of paratroopers ringed the airport, which was shut down for 3 hours. That didn't count the honor guard, of course, all of whom felt as though they had no honor at all, that it had been stripped away from their army and their nation by them. Esteban Cardinal Valdez prayed over the coffins, accompanied by the chief rabbi of Bogota's small Jewish community. The vice president attended on behalf of the American government, and one by one the Colombian army handed the caskets over to enlisted pallbearers from all of the American uniformed services. The usual predictable speeches were made, the most eloquent being a brief address by Colombia's attorney general, who shed unashamed tears for his friend and college classmate. The vice president boarded his aircraft and left, followed by the big Lockheed transport. The president's statement, already delivered, spoke of reaffirming the rule of law to which Emil Jacobs had dedicated his life. But that statement seemed as thin as the air at El Dorado International, even to those who didn't know better. In the town of 8 Mile, Alabama, a suburb of Mobile, a police sergeant named Ernie Braden was cutting his front lawn with a riding mower. A burglary investigator, he knew all the tricks of the people whose crimes he handled, including how to bypass complex alarm systems, even the sophisticated models used by wealthy investment bankers. That skill, plus the information he picked up from office chatter, the narc's bullpen was right next to the burglary section, enabled him to offer his services to people who had money with which to pay for the orthodonture and education of his children. It wasn't so much that Braden was a corrupt cop as that he'd simply been on the job for over 20 years and no longer gave much of a damn. If people wanted to use drugs, then to hell with them. If druggies wanted to kill one another off, then so much the better for the rest of society. And if some arrogant prick of a banker turned out to be a crook among crooks, then that was also too bad. All Braden had been asked to do was shake the man's house to make sure that he'd left no records behind. It was a shame about the man's wife and kids, of course, but that was called playing with fire. Braden rationalized the damage done to society simply by continuing to investigate his burglaries and even catching a real hood from time to time, though that was rare enough. Burglary was a pretty safe crime to commit. It never got the attention it deserved. Neither did the people whose job it was to track them down, probably the most unrewarded segment of the law enforcement profession. He'd been taking the lieutenant's exam for 9 years and never quite made it. Braden needed, or at least wanted, the money that the promotion would bring, only to see the promotions go to the hotshots in narcotics and homicide while he slaved away. And why not take the goddamn money? More than anything else, Ernie Braden was tired of it all. Tired of the long hours, tired of the crime victims who took their frustration out on him when he was just trying to do his job. Tired of being unappreciated within his own community of police officers. Tired of being sent out to local schools for the pro forma anti-crime lectures that nobody ever listened to. He was even tired of coaching Little League Baseball, though that had once been the single joy of his life. Tired of just about everything. But he couldn't afford to retire either, not yet anyway. The noise from the Sears riding mower crackled through the hot, humid air of the quiet street on which he and his family lived. He wiped a handkerchief across his sweaty brow and contemplated the cold beer he'd have as soon as he was finished. It could have been worse. Until 3 years ago, he'd pushed a goddamned lawn boy across the grass. At least now he could sit down as he did his weekly chore, cutting the goddamn grass. His wife had a real thing about the lawn and garden. As if it mattered, Braden grumbled. He concentrated on the job at hand, making sure that the spinning blades had at least 2 sweeps over every square inch of the green crap that, this early in the season, grew almost as fast as you cut it. He didn't notice the Plymouth minivan coming down the street.